Hello, pragmatists, Jacks and Jills of multiple trades, authorpreneurs, and side hustlers. Thanks for joining us here on Right Minded, and we are grateful to you for listening to our show. I'm Brooke Warner. I'm here with my fellow side hustler, Grant Faulkner. Though, Grant, I sometimes think that we're doing too many side hustles, and we do a lot of side hustles that don't earn us any money. Of course, we do side hustles for other reasons, but still, I don't know if we're even allowed to call them side hustles if we're not bringing in any income. What do you think?
we're low rent side hustlers, perhaps. Yeah, it's true. Writers, a lot is required of writers these days, you know, going to readings, you know, all sorts of things where it takes a whole evening to drive there and you don't really get paid for it. You're just doing it for the visibility or to support a bookstore or a library or something. But yeah, there's a lot to do. And sometimes you do need a little, you got to pay the rent, right? One story I just want to share on this note is my friend Rachel Herron. She's a fantastic NaNoWriMo writer as well. She's on the NaNoWriMo Writers Board, but she is who I think of as the quintessential hustling writer. And the reason I want to mention for the theme of this show is that every year she writes this great blog post, and she reveals how much money she makes as a writer, and she tells each of its sources. She presents a pie chart. So, you know, 10% might come from teaching classes. Another 10% might come from coaching writers. 30% might come from self-publishing. Then she's got a traditional publishing wedge on the pie chart. But anyway, it's very instructive because it shows how many different things a writer has to do to make a living in the world. And she's so upfront and frank about it and open that I think more writers should do that. And I say I should do that as well because I think it's very instructive. And in fact, Rachel just wrote an article on this for the Writer magazine. It's in their current, their December issue, I think. But so if you just Google her, you can either read about her hustling life as a writer on her blog or in the Writer magazine.
Yeah, that's so helpful when people are so transparent in that way. And I'm really glad that we're talking about this topic actually around making ends meet as a writer, because quite honestly, I don't know any authors who are able to live solely off the fruits of their writing alone. The career writers and even the best-selling authors I know are all teaching or speaking, editing, consulting, whatever things they might do. And that's great because they're making a career that orbits their writing in some way. But the idea that anyone can just be a writer and nothing else, I think that's something of the way, way past. And I don't even know if it was a thing of the way, way past. I don't know, Grant, you're a student of history. So do any of your literary heroes of eras past come to mind for having been able to just write and nothing else? Or have writers always had means or patrons or independent wealth?
You know, I always say that I can count the number of writers who make a living off of their writing on my fingers. And I think that's pretty much true. There are not many more writers than 10 who do make a living solely off their writing. And there aren't many, and there never have been. Jane Friedman, when we had her on Right Minded a year ago or so ago, she went through the history of writing, and most for most history, writers were either rich or they had rich patrons, at least the ones who were published. And there have been many different types of patrons as well throughout history. For example, both F. Scott Fitzgerald and William Faulkner, they relied on going to Hollywood to really sell their souls as they saw it. It was a burnout enterprise, at least creatively, but they wrote scripts to fund their novel writing. And now so many writers teach. And I mean, it's a lucky era for writers when you think about it, because I think there's something like 600 MFA programs in the United States now. And if you think about it, 50 or 60 years ago, there were probably only 10 or so. So that's a lot of jobs for writers, and a lot. It really, really fuels and supports the writing life, the teaching life in creative writing programs. And then there are people like me. You know, I've been sort of a handyman or utility infielder of writing. You know, I was a journalist, then worked in corporate communications, then worked in nonprofit communications. Have done a bunch of freelancing of all kinds of things, and now work at a writing nonprofit. So I think there are more jobs than ever for writers, but very few where you just get to sit and write novels.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to talk about that as the fantasy that many writers have, that they're just going to sit back, write that book, and then, as you said, contemplate your novel or retire in some way. And in her book, Big Magic, Elizabeth Gilbert has a section about the importance of not quitting your day job. And it's called Your Day Job. And I just want to summarize, because she talks about how she held on to her own day job for a long time, maybe even longer than was necessary in her case, because she had seen too many other friends of hers, as she said, murder their creativity through demanding that it pay the bills. And I like this frank way of talking about that, a bit of tough love from her here too, when she asserts that it's childish actually to have the expectation or to demand that your creativity take care of you in that way, and that you're not unique if you're a working artist. You know, that's what everyone does. And it's an important message for writers to hear, because I don't think enough people are rooted in reality when it comes to the real life possibilities when it comes to their writing. I personally talk to a lot of writers, and I'm always surprised by how often I hear from people at conferences or who sometimes contact me for consults or coaching that they want to have what they call a next career as a writer, and that they want to bring in income with their writing, but they're really talking about it just as selling books. And I often find myself talking to them about, you know, it has to be more than that. It's bigger than that. And what else would you do, you know, if you were lucky enough to have a successful book? So on the one hand, I hate to be the person who's always going to burst the fantasy bubble for these writers, but I also feel like it's my responsibility, even if it is a buzzkill, because I want writers to be realistic and to be savvy about what it means to write and publish a book, right? I mean, we're talking about a book. I mean, some of them might be thinking about being career writers, but I do feel like so many writers' conferences that I attend are selling the dream. And the dream just can often look a lot different than most writers imagine. And Grant, you're living the dream. You know, you have traditionally published books. You have, you know, you do have the strong backing of a house. You self-publish some of your own books, but you have an agent. So how close or far is the dream that you have now, you know, from the dream that you had as a young writer?
Yeah, it is a very funny statement that I'm living the dream, I have to say. I think the chasm between my real life and the dream is really quite wide. You know, when I think about when I first became an author, and I really did literally think that I would be living this exotic life in Paris and writing in cafes and just kind of waiting for my royalty checks to arrive in the mail. And I loved when I was young and could indulge in such dreams and fantasies, because why not? And they still play a role. It's nice to think that you're going to have that breakthrough and that kind of wonderful life. But the reality is more akin to the word hustle you mentioned at the beginning. Being a working writer is a large part about hustling. You know, a friend of mine from high school I recently saw, and he just assumed I was rich because I'd published a book. You know, I think there is this strange idea that books are big, big, big money makers, and they aren't. The truth is that book helped me to pay down my credit card debt. I don't have an apartment in Paris with that income. And I actually have a theory. You know, this is unrevealed, but so many writers, they'll get an advance for a book of $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000, and that can sound up a lot, like a lot of money. But if you tally up all the time they spend writing their books, working with their editors, promoting their books, I think most writers actually earn less than minimum wage. So it's not about getting rich. It's really about earning a very basic income that's a second or third job in your life. And I'm not saying this to complain. You know, even though I dreamed of a successful writerly life in Paris, I also became a writer with my eyes wide open. And I think that's important to do at each stage. And I'm pleased with my life as a writer. It gives me many things that are far more important than money, such as a rich life.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I've never been living the writing dream either, Grant. So it's okay. Maybe we can put our income together when we retire to get a flat in Paris, but probably not.
Yeah, I think more like a trailer somewhere.
Exactly. A trailer somewhere in a rural part of the United States. You know, I wrote my first book after I left my job at Seal, and I was already somewhat jaded about the world of traditional publishing by that point. And of course, I would have never published on a traditional publisher since I have She Writes Press. And it's one of the great blessings of running this publishing company that I'll never have to think about how or where I publish. But I have always understood that my books would be vehicles, that they would open doors for me, that they would be platform builders. And so the books I've written, I feel, give me credibility and legitimacy. I know that they have gotten me invitations to speak and sit on panels, and I do a lot of conferences, but not a lot of those things are money makers. I mean, the way in which they're money makers is by visibility and contributing to my visibility, and then hopefully people hire me more. Certainly because of visibility, more authors come to She Writes Press and to Spark Press. So it's just an interesting thing to look at the ripple effect when you're thinking about the multiple income streams that you might have as a result of publishing a book. And, you know, I thought that if I had a published book, then my would-be clients would see that I wasn't just a coach, but that I'd also gone through the process of writing and publishing myself, which would lend some more sense of what they're going through, I do think it makes me more empathetic because I know what it's like to be in their shoes. So just all of those things, you know, there's the side hustle and kind of how you do it, how you think about it. And I love to be in the trenches with my authors, which is one of the reasons that it's not one of the reasons I write books, but it's certainly one of the things that I've thought of that is helpful that I am also a published author.
Yeah, I think you got to figure out what sort of side hustles work for you. You know, going back to Rachel, I think she's given up book coaching. She doesn't like that as much, but you know, she's teaching and writing in different forms and doing all sorts of other things. And beyond the hustle, though, I mean, because it is really defining yourself as a writer, what parts of the hustle work for you and what parts of writing work for you. And I always tell people that you really have to like writing just for the sake of writing to be a writer in the end. I mean, at its best, you're in service to your story. And I view that service as being, you know, practically sacred. You don't meditate for money. You don't exercise for money. You don't take care of your children or your friends or your parents for money. So, you know, I think that the best things in life, you don't get paid for.
Good insight there. So I'm excited to talk to today's guest about all of this and this topic in general, because Caroline Leavitt is such an honest voice around all this. And, you know, the reality of writing being a career, kind of the ups and downs, the peaks and valleys, as she's going to describe it, and how even if you have a huge success, you can't pin your future on that. She's a novelist and also an editor, and she knows a thing or two about the side hustle. So we have the treat of connecting with her in just a few short moments. So hold tight and we will be right back. We are back, everybody, with today's guest, Caroline Leavitt. And Caroline is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author. And just listening to this list of books is going to make you dizzy. She has written Is This Tomorrow?, Pictures of You, Girls in Trouble, Coming Back to Me, Living Other Lives, Into Thin Air, Family, Jealousies, Lifelines, Meeting Rosie Halfway, Cruel, Beautiful World, and her upcoming novel, which is coming out in August of 2020, With or Without You. Her books have been optioned for film, translated into multiple languages, and condensed in magazines. Her ninth novel, Pictures of You, is a New York Times bestseller and a Costco Penny's Pick, among its multiple other accolades. Caroline has been a judge in the Writer's Voice Fiction Awards in New York City and the Mid-Atlantic Arts Grants in Fiction, and she also teaches for Stanford University and UCLA Extension Writers. Caroline, hello. You live in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is New York City's unofficial sixth borough, which we know. Caroline, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
One of the things I really like and appreciate about you is your candor. And so we're inviting you into a bit of a candid conversation today as we talk about what it takes to make it as a writer. And I wonder if you'd tell our listeners about what you thought your life as a writer was going to be like when you were in your 20s and publishing your first book, and what you understand about being a career writer today after having published 11 novels with the 12th on the way.
That's a great question. I got very lucky in that I always thought that I was going to be a short story writer. And after I published a few books of short stories, I would write a novel. And instead, what happened is in my mid-20s, I published a short story and it won a contest. And suddenly I had an agent, and suddenly the agent said, you have a publisher who wants to make this a novel. So I had to learn really fast. And my first novel was a sensation. And I thought, oh, it's always going to be like this. Every year or so, I'll write a novel and my career will just grow and grow and grow. And it didn't happen that way. Although my first novel was a smash, by the time my second novel came out, my publisher was going out of business. So I was orphaned and I had to find another publisher. And believe it or not, they went out of business too. So I decided that I wanted a publisher, which was going to be a big publisher and give me a 3-book deal. And I got that. And unfortunately, they didn't do a lot of publicity and those books died too. So I had written virtually and published 8 novels without anybody really knowing who I was or really making any money at all. And on my 9th novel, which was Pictures of You, that novel was actually rejected on contract by my then publisher as not being special enough. And I figured that my career was over, because if you haven't sold anything, you know, in 8 books, who would want to pick me up? But luckily, I had a writer friend who got me to her editor at Algonquin, and they bought the book. And I told them, you know, I don't really sell books. And they said, oh, don't be silly. You will now. And they took that book and they got it in 6 printings months before it even came out. And it became my first New York Times bestseller. So in a way, I've learned that a career is not a trajectory that goes from the bottom to the top. A writing career can, it has all sorts of hills and valleys. And I feel like you just have to persevere and you just have to think about the work, what you're writing. And you have to know that, you know, some books hit and some books don't. And the main thing is just to keep writing and doing what you love.
That's such a great story. So inspiring, Caroline. I'm wondering, like, what do you think are the most important qualities that writers need to have today if they want to succeed? Like, how do you advise writers you work with in terms of handling expectations or setting expectations?
Well, first, I tell them to never give up. You know, that no doesn't always mean no. Even if you get a rejection from an agent, you can always write back to the agent and say, if I revise this, would you be willing to look at it again? And 90% of the time they do that. The important thing about being a writer today is building up a community, which I think is really, really super important, because writers help each other, or they should help each other. And you can find them on Facebook. You can find them on Twitter. You go out to lunch with them, go to bookstore readings, do something like NaNoWriMo to meet people. Because the thing is, the more that you know in the community, the more help you get. Somebody, I mean, I got my New York Times bestseller because of a writer friend introduced me to her editor, and it was an editor that my agent had never worked with. So there's all these things that come out. That's how you can get blurbs for your book too, by knowing other writers. You can get people to read your manuscript and you read theirs. It just makes you feel really so much less alone. And it's an important thing to do, I think.
I agree about community. So thanks for saying that. And you do a lot in addition to your writing. You teach, you work with writers privately. So that means you're doing manuscript assessments and editing, and you can tell us what else. But how did you carve out this niche? And was it out of necessity, or is there more to the story than that?
I think there's more to the story. I grew up as this incredibly shy person, and I was pretty much a loner. I never shared my writing to anybody until I would say my 6th novel, maybe. And I began to realize that maybe it wasn't such a healthy thing for me to be so alone. So I began to, reach out to writers on the internet. And at first it was just so thrilling to be able to have a conversation with a writer I loved. And sometimes the conversation was just about cake, not necessarily about writing, and then to actually go and be able to meet someone. And I began to know more and more writers. And as we talked, I began to realize that, you know, it's really hard to get reviews, and it's really hard to know about what goes on. And I began to think that, you know what, karmically, I'm a big believer in karma, karmically, it might be a really good thing if I started a blog, which my publisher was sort of pushing me to do anyway. But I didn't want to write about myself. And I thought, well, this would be a great way for me to interview writers who I love, that maybe they're not getting the publicity that bigger writers are getting, or maybe they are getting publicity and I just want to know them. And it would be a great way to introduce their work to people, or to, you know, get them to a wider audience. And it would be great for me because I could ask them the questions that I really wanted to know about what it was like for them to be a writer. So I started this blog, and to my surprise, it took off. And I began to have publishers asking me, you know, would you be willing to interview this writer or that writer? And I'm always really happy to do that, because first of all, it opens up the community. Second of all, it, you know, it joins writers together. And third of all, it helps to sell books. I also review books. I review books for People and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Boston Globe. But there's a kind of ethics involved in that, and that I'm not allowed to review any book by a friend or by anybody that I know. So part of why the blog is so great is I can always tell my friends, look, I can't review you, but I can put you on the blog. And the blog goes to Amazon and Goodreads, and I put it all over social media. So I just felt it was part of being a good literary citizen. And it makes me feel really good. And it makes me feel part of the conversation to do something good for other writers.
That's interesting, Caroline. You know, most writers have 9-to-5 jobs, but I think most writers also imagine they won't have to at some point. And I'm one of those writers. I've always had a 9-to-5 job. And yet I've certainly fantasized about how it would be to just be at my desk all day contemplating my novel. In fact, I still fantasize about this. I don't know. I'm still playing the lottery, I guess, in my mind. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about this fantasy that writers have. And what do you say to writers who talk to you about retiring once they get a book published, or even who seek you out because they want to turn their book into a New York Times bestseller?
You know, there's the myth of the writer who has the beach house and doesn't have to work. I've always, up until, you know, even when I had a New York Times bestseller, I still work, and I work really, really hard. It's impossible, except for very, very few writers, to make a living just from your books, unless you sell a movie, which happens very far and few between. I mean, I teach at Stanford and UCLA. I'm a professional namer, so I'm always working on that. I do manuscript consults, and I've built up that business. But, you know, I worked jobs for years and years, and it was really, really hard, because there are some writers who can do really hard jobs, like be a doctor or be a lawyer or be in business, and be able to write when they come home. I was not one of those people. So I always had to find 9-to-5 jobs that sort of were really easy for me. And I wrote catalog copy for Macy's for years and years, full time. But I liked it because it was a job that when the day was done, I could go home and it was done. So I always tell writers, if you have to work a 9-to-5 job, it's just sort of wiggling around your schedule. Instead of taking lunch, use that hour to write. Instead of being at the office at 9, get up an hour early so you can write then, right during the slow times. It's just a question of moving your hours around. But I don't know anybody, except for my few writer friends who are married to doctors or lawyers, who doesn't have to do any other sort of work. We all work, and we all work really, really hard. I don't know what it would be like to just, you know, be a writer and not have to do anything else. To me, that would be like winning the lottery too.
Well, and talk to us about this balance, because you happen now to have work that in some ways I think competes with the writing, because you're working with other writers. So how do you balance that? And is the writing a top priority, or does it take a necessary backseat sometimes?
It depends on the bills, to tell you the truth. I carefully make a budget for every month so I can figure out, okay, I need to do 5 manuscript consults so we can pay the mortgage or whatever else. And I always am teaching a class. It also depends on my deadlines. If I have a deadline to get something into my publisher, then that takes precedence. I'm able to put myself in different heads for doing the writing work and for doing the, you know, the real paying work for the mortgage stuff. I usually try to do the writing work first. I can't write for more than 4 hours at a time, which is probably good, because then I have those other hours to do my other work. But after 4 hours, I just feel depleted and exhausted. And also, I need very little sleep. I'm sort of lucky. So I've been able to manage it that way.
Caroline, when you're talking about your writing copy for Macy's catalog, it reminds me of a lot of the things I've done as a writer. I think you find yourself in strange places.
Oh, yeah.
I always say that I've written everything except a vacuum cleaner manual. And
I've done that.
Yeah, and I expect to before I die, so I'll join you. I'm curious, what is your absolute favorite gig that you've done?
My favorite gig? outside of writing, you know what? Naming. I worked for this company for a while called Eat My Words, and I would name things. I would name products and restaurants, and it was just so much fun. And what they do is they give you, the client gives you a brief, and the names belong to the company, but I can tell you one of the names because they never used it. They came to me where they wanted the name of a restaurant. It was going to be Indian street food, but they wanted it to have an American twist. So I came up with, you know, you come up with 500 names, and it's really fun to do. And then it goes through legal to make sure that it doesn't mean something pornographic in another language. And I came up with this name, Jakarta Jones, and they all loved it. They said, "Ah, oh, this is really great. We want it." And then it went through legal, and it turned out they couldn't use it because there was a real life Jakarta Jones who was a serial killer in India. But it was the best work. It was the best job and the most fun. And every now and again, I get a naming job, but that work has sort of dried up a little. So I need to sort of find some more of that kind of stuff, because that was a dream job. Easy, fun.
That sounds super fun. I want it.
Caroline, I'm wondering how often you publish a new book. You just finished one, or it's coming out soon. It's coming out in August. So are you already working on another book, or already drafting another book, or do you give yourself some time in between?
I don't give myself time, and I'm kind of neurotic, actually. I have this sense that I don't know. I got really sick after I had my son 23 years ago and almost died, and I survived. And after I survived, I've always had this feeling that, you know, time is, you never know what's going to happen. So I want to do everything fast. I always have an idea for another book before something else comes out. And as a matter of fact, I've just submitted to Algonquin a synopsis and 80 pages of a new novel that I'm hoping that they will buy in a partial, and then I'll write it. And as if that wasn't enough to drive myself crazy, then I decided, well, maybe I can get a two-book deal. And so I started another synopsis actually last week that I'm also going to present to them. But I'm always writing. I'm always sort of looking ahead, because I never want to have that feeling where I feel, what am I going to write about? Or I have no ideas. They've all dried up. I'm a failure. And that kind of thinking.
Well, I love how prolific you are. And thanks for showing people kind of how it's done. I mean, you have to have a lot of irons in the fire, and you're a great model for that. So thank you for being with us today.
Yeah. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you so much for having me.
We will be right back with Brooke's takeaway today.
So today's takeaway, I'm just going to pick up where I left off with Big Magic. There's this exercise that Liz Gilbert did in a workshop of hers that I attended in Napa a few years ago. And I thought about it as I was looking at that section for Big Magic. It's a great exercise, and it is to write a letter to yourself from some aspect of yourself that wants to have a voice. So Big Magic, for those of you who've read it, you know, is divided into sections like courage, persistence, divinity, and others. So you might start here. You'd write a letter to yourself from your courage, or from your persistence, or from your divinity. So you would write the words "dear" and then insert your name, because you're writing a letter to yourself. And then you would follow with "I am your courage" or "I am your persistence." From here, you give voice to this aspect of yourself and you see what it holds for you. And I promise this is a really moving exercise. I was blown away by what my own self had to say to me. And, you know, compartmentalizing an aspect of self in this way is actually very helpful. When I did it, it made me realize that there were all of these parts of me that steal the show, that are much louder than my inspiration or my persistence, for instance. And so I'm very busy listening to those other stronger voices, and then don't make room for courage or divinity. So give voice to any aspect of yourself that you want. It could be others that we haven't named here, and it could even be negative voices like anger or resentment, because sometimes just flushing that out a bit can be helpful. So write a letter to yourself. If you like the exercise, do more. Discover the inherent wisdom of the many aspects of yourself.
Thanks so much, Brooke. That's a great exercise. And thank you, listeners, for listening every week and for rating us on the podcast channels and for writing reviews. They're so fun. I'm going to read this one from T. Grimm 21. So happy to find this podcast. I'm just coincidentally reading a 5-star rating here, but actually almost all of them are 5-star ratings. So very grateful for that, that you like this podcast. And T. Grimm 21 says, found this podcast in September and had to binge listen. I'm all caught up from the first episode as of today. Wow, that is impressive. As I venture into writing my first novel during NaNoWriMo, I found this podcast to be filled with loads of great information and tips to help me get started. I can't begin to say how thankful I am for this podcast, and I can't begin to say how thankful I am to you for listening and to all of our listeners. So Right Minded is a weekly podcast, except we will not be back next week. We have these holidays. We want to take some time off, but continue downloading it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and keep leaving ratings. We love reading your ratings and your reviews. When we come back next time, we're going to have a special New Year's episode about recharging. So come back and listen on December 30th.